Welcome to Reconquest on the Crusade Channel of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie coming to you from St. Benedict Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. My email address is bambam@Catholicism.org. I can also be found easily on Twitter @brother_Andre and on Facebook. Tonight's show is entitled Blessed Karl von Habsburg, Statesman and Victim. My guest in the second segment will be Mr. Charles Coulomb, the founder, the noted Catholic author and historian. And he's going to be here to discuss with us the House of Habsburg and Blessed Emperor Karl and related things. On to the first segment, and I'm going to give a rapid-fire sort of bio of Blessed Karl von Habsburg. Those of you who are familiar with him might be a little bored by this, but it'll be review for you. Those of you who don't know him, this might whet your appetite to learn more. Blessed Karl von Habsburg was born on August the 17th, 1887, and died at the age of April 1st, 1922. He died at the age, of 34 on April 1st, 1922. When he was born, it was not considered likely that he would reign, or if he would, his rule would be as a much older man, having succeeded two uncles and his father, all of whom were in line after the then reigning Emperor Franz Joseph. But after the suicide of Emperor Franz Joseph's only son, Archduke Rudolf, and then the early death of Blessed Karl's own father, Otto, and then the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in 1914, which, of course, led to World War I, all this changed things and put him right in line to succeed his uncle, Emperor Franz Joseph, both as Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and as King of Hungary. Blessed Karl von Habsburg received an excellent education. At the age of 16, he was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Imperial Army. He quickly became known as a thoughtful, loyal, and dependable young soldier, an inspiration to his fellow soldiers. He earned promotions and rose up the ranks of the Imperial Army. 5 years before assuming the throne, and oblivious to just how near he was to it, he married the beautiful, vivacious, and devout Princess Zita of the House of Bourbon-Parma. They would eventually have 8 children, 5 born during good times, and 3 born when the family were sadly reduced to poverty. Karl proposed to Zita in the Marian shrine of Mariazell before the Blessed Sacrament, and he placed their engagement under the protection of the Blessed Virgin Mary. This is in Austria. Mariazell is a major place of pilgrimage in Austria, which shrine, by the way, houses a statue of Our Lady under the title Magna Mater Austriae, Great Mother of Austria. So it was likely in very close proximity to that statue that he proposed to Princess Zita, then Princess Zita, in front of the Blessed Sacrament. The marriage took place on October 21st, 1911, which, by the way, is his feast day. When Pope John Paul II beatified him, he made the feast day October 21st, not the date of Karl's death, April 1st. And I think this is a deliberate statement, a sort of pro-family, pro-marriage statement to show how important that sacrament was. And how important was that sacrament to Karl? Well, on the eve of it, on the eve of their marriage, he said to Zita, "Now we must help each other get to heaven." Karl and Zita's family and devotion to God were their first priorities. During these years, they tried to live a simple, quiet life while Karl continued his military career. In the home, there were always daily family devotions, the rosary, novenas, scripture reading, family catechism, daily mass, and particular pious practices promoted by the Habsburgs, such as devotion to the Blessed Sacrament, to the Holy Cross, to the Immaculate Conception, and to the Feast of Corpus Christi. On June 28, 1914, word came from Sarajevo that the heir apparent, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, had been assassinated, making Karl the new heir apparent. As a consequence of the assassination, war broke out and quickly engulfed all of Europe. Karl is called to lead various military actions and comports himself with valor and honor, leading victorious campaigns on the southern and eastern fronts of the war. In Italy, he commanded his officers to avoid needless bloodshed and, I quote here, quote, to ensure that the wounded are taken care of as quickly as possible and that the troops are always provided for as well as possible. I forbid the order to take no prisoners. I forbid most emphatically stealing and plundering and wanton destruction. Every soldier in the 20th Corps must be filled with the conviction that we are bearers of culture, even in the land of traitors. Italy, by the way, had switched sides, so he's calling them traitors. So we are the bearers of culture, even in the land of traitors. Emperor Karl, blessed Emperor Karl, obviously had a very exalted sense of Catholic just war doctrine, an exalted and committed adherence to it, such as we discussed in our last show when we were talking about the Crusades and just war doctrine. In November of 1916, right in the middle of the war, he was called to the deathbed of his great uncle, Emperor Franz Joseph, who died on the 21st of that month, leaving Karl as his successor. Imagine being such a young man and being called Your Majesty for the first time at the deathbed of your great uncle. As emperor, Karl set the peace and security of his empire as his first task. He wanted to bring about a speedy end to the war, and he therefore entered into secret peace negotiations through two brothers-in-law, the princes Sixtus and Xavier of Bourbon-Parma, this would be Zita's brothers, who served in the Belgian military. So they were on the other side, okay, family on the other side. This effort at peace and another initiative that Karl made later both failed. That later effort, by the way, was his attempt to second Pope Benedict XV's attempt to make peace between the belligerent powers. Blessed Karl's selflessness and his desire for peace was not seconded by the leaders of the other belligerent parties, neither among the Central Powers nor among the Entente Powers, the Allies. The dogs of war would not heal. A coterie of Freemasons, Socialists, Communists, and such like wanted to remap Europe into their own image, and they put an end to the last Catholic world power. The Empire, they thought, must die. We all know that Blessed Karl was on the losing side of the war. And after the loss, this is where things get really ugly for him. He refused to abdicate the throne, considering that this was something that he had had given to him as a trust and as a sacred duty from God. He was therefore exiled to Switzerland. And after an unsuccessful attempt to recover the throne of Hungary, keep in mind, under separate formalities, he's the emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he is the king, the apostolic king, a title going all the way back to St. Stephen of Hungary. And therefore, he wore the famous crown of St. Stephen, and you can find a picture of him in an article on the Catholicism.org website that we've linked to from reconquest.net. So he goes to he's exiled to Switzerland. He tries to regain his throne in Hungary. He has loyalists in Hungary who bring him in, but the traitorous and oath-breaking and otherwise contemptible Admiral Horthy, who was supposed to be ruling in his place and who had taken an oath that he would help to restore the king, he handed him over. Admiral Horthy handed Blessed Karl over to the Entente powers, and he was therefore exiled again, not to Switzerland now this time, but to the cold, damp island of Madeira, a Portuguese holding off the coast of Africa. It was known that Karl had weak lungs and was prone to pneumonia, so this was something of a cynically clever death sentence. The plan worked. Karl contracted pneumonia. On his deathbed, he forgave all of his enemies, especially the Masons among them. He declared in an emphatic voice, "I have to suffer so much in order that my people may be united again." Then, kissing a crucifix, he began to pray in what sounded like a dialogue. "Thy holy will be done. Jesus, Jesus, come. Yes, yes, my Jesus, as thou willest it." Conscious to the very end, the emperor gave up the ghost, exhaling with his last breath, "Jesus." This is Brother Andre Marie. The show is Reconquest. You're listening to the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. And continuing with the story of Blessed Karl von Habsburg, I should mention one other thing about his death. It's a very moving death. He died with the holy name of Jesus on his lips. But one of the last things that happened before he died, when he knew he was going to die, was he brought in his oldest son, Otto, who was the heir apparent, who would have succeeded him if the throne had remained. And he said, "I want my son to see how an emperor dies." Now, I don't have the exact quote in front of me. I neglected to put it in my notes. But he wanted his son to see how an emperor comports himself under such circumstances. And he gave his son Otto a very, very good example. Otto, by the way, only died a few years ago. He was in his 90s. And he was a man who lived for the service of the church and what remained of Christian Europe to the very end. Now, there's a few lessons that we can derive out of the life of Emperor Karl. And I realize I just gave a pole vault jump version over his life. But I'm going to borrow heavily. I borrowed heavily, by the way, from Brother Nathan Cochran, OSB, a Benedictine brother who promoted the cause of Blessed Karl. And I'm going to borrow very heavily now from Gary Potter, whose article on this subject is linked from reconquest.net. Gary draws out five lessons from Emperor Karl's life that I think we need to consider. And I'm going to read you exactly as he wrote it. So yes, I'm sort of plagiarizing here. First, he was a champion of peace and reconciliation. His statesmanship in seeking an honorable peace to end World War I provides a model for political leaders today who do not scruple to wage war even in anticipatory self-defense. His deathbed forgiveness of his enemies, including the Masons, challenges the many forms of hatred that abound today. His example is instructive to the public as well as to leaders. Second, he was a champion of social justice. Now, to those of you who think that's a bad word, there's a good use of that phrase, social justice. It does not imply socialism, communism, Marxism, or liberalism. Influenced by Pope Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum, great social justice encyclical, he established a ministry of social welfare to implement the church's social doctrine. His personal commitment to social justice is shown in his use of his carriages and coaches to transport coal to the poor during the war. His implementation of papal social encyclicals sets an example for public officials looking to solve today's economic and social problems. And Gary points out, by the way, that what elected officials today are going to use their limos to bring coal or fuel or food to the needy hungry. Yet this supposedly spoiled, privileged man who didn't care, you know, let them eat cake. That's how we Americans often think of the royalty. This man used the royal carriage to deliver coal to the poor during the war so they wouldn't suffer. Third, he was a champion of Austro-Slavonic unity and minority ethnic rights. This is very important. Foreseeing Russian dominion over the smaller Slavonic and other ethnic nations sandwiched between Russia and the Prussian empires, Karl strove to transform his own centralized empire into a confederation of individual ethnic nations, each having internal autonomy, but with their security and other benefits provided by a united defense, a common market, economic and financial union, and foreign policy. Had he succeeded, both Hitler and Stalin would have been blocked. What he tried to do still makes geopolitical and economic good sense. Here, Venerable Karl sets an example for ethnic reconciliation and unity among Eastern European peoples still trying to adjust themselves to the circumstances that arose with the fall of the Iron Curtain. By the way, this is a prime example of what we would have spoken of when we interviewed Dr. Wilhelmsen on fueros, the concept of local rights, local rule. In other words, in this large empire, he would have turned the empire into something of a confederation where those ethnic groups, which tended to have internal strife with each other, would have a lot of local autonomy, a lot of local rule. They'd have their own local customs. It wouldn't be one gigantic homogenized amalgamation of a nation. There'd be a lot of localism under such a thing, including local rule, but all of it under the empire with all these common protections and advantages that come from the union that they would have had in the empire. Fourth, he was a champion of family, of Christian family life. The fact that as head of state, of a nation at war, he found time for daily mass, family devotions, and catechism classes, gives the lie to our modern excuse of lack of time to pay due attention to our religious obligations. The life of the family he headed stands in contrast to the spirit of a society dominated by liberal materialism and where mortal sin is a normal and socially accepted way of life. The emphasis he placed on Christian formation of his children and the role of the family as the school or domestic church in which this formation should take place makes him an example to modern families struggling against the allures of alternative lifestyles. His deathbed prayer for the perseverance of his children from mortal sin gives pause for reflection in a society where contraception, abortion, sexual freedom, and uninhibited sodomy are considered human rights. We need the example of Venerable Emperor. Gary wrote this, by the way, when Carl was yet a venerable. Blessed Emperor Carl's family, Christian life in an era when highly organized forces, feminism, the homosexualist movement, secular humanism, etc., are crusading to destroy the family as an institution. Finally, the emperor was a champion of the preborn. The thought of his laying his hand on Zita's womb to pray for their unborn daughter, this would be Archduchess Elizabeth, who was their last child, who was in utero during this time. The fact that he did that challenges contemporary society, where the human sacrifice of abortion on the altar of liberal democracy is defended as a right. Further, although the first five of his eight children were born while he possessed his civil list, that is, the salary that he's got as emperor, the last three came into the world after he had been dethroned and left penniless. By the way, they didn't have enough money for heat in the summer home that they lived in. They had to borrow somebody's summer home. I believe it was a physician's summer home in Madeira, in the island of Madeira, and it was cold, wet, damp, etc., and had mold on the walls when they went in there. Because of this, he was driven to his death. He contracted pneumonia. This sets an especially instructive example for the many modern couples who deliberately limit the number of their children or have none at all, choosing instead an affluent lifestyle over having a family. So when Emperor Karl was put in a position where he was poor, they still continued to have children. They still continued to be generous with God, and they didn't contracept or do anything that was going to minimize the size of their family because of their difficult circumstances. This is Brother Andre Marie. You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. When we come back after the break, I'm going to be interviewing via Skype my guest, Mr. Charles Coulomb. Please stick around.
You're listening to Reconquest with Brother Andre Marie, seeking that which was lost and fighting for it, exclusively on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.